What if a single color could capture the essence of a people's history? In her new book, Black and Blues, How a Color Tells the Story of My People, National Book Award winner Imani Perry makes the argument that blue does just that. The Harvard professor traces the deep connections between the Black experience and the color blue. In her writing, she travels time and space, telling stories ranging from the origin of blues music to those demonstrating the spirituality and strength that rests in that mysterious hue. With her as my griot guide, we boarded an imaginary time ship and embarked on a journey through blue-black history. I launched our adventure by asking Imani Perry where she started noticing the connection between black and blue.
I mean, I think obviously the blues, you know, having heard that the entirety of my life. And then there is Langston Hughes has this beautiful poem about the blue of Alabama skies. And I remember reading that poem at a very young age and feeling like, oh, that's my home. You know, the sort of the blackness and the bluesness of the space was so, you know, apparent. And then, you know, once you start following those like little threads, it becomes increasingly sort of obvious that the blues are called the blues for a reason, you know?
Yeah, and at one point, and you write about this in the book, black people were actually referred to as blue.
Yeah, that was an interesting tidbit that I did not know before I started working on this book, that there were Europeans, people in the UK, who referred to black people as blue. And I found it as I was researching because I wanted to make the point that we were called by different names, people of African descent, and even the designation Africa is not something that black people chose. Our language is so bound up with the history of European empires, it's hard to get out of it. And so blue was one of those designations. And blackness really comes about as a way of describing people of African descent in the midst of the slave trade. And so I was interested. I said, oh, that's interesting that blue was one of those designations. Mm-hmm. But then there's also the process by which black people sort of took this on and embraced it and created something beautiful out of what was intended to be something degrading. And that I was really interested in capturing. Mm-hmm. You know, that to me is sort of, for me, is the essence of blackness. It's not the fact that we're called this thing, but that we make meaning of it.
I saw you as this time traveler, this person, and in my mind, you're like this caped individual, and you got on a blue cape, and it's velvet, right?
I love that.
And you're literally flying the reader through time, space, and it's like we're going through two different dimensions, and you're honing in on blue.
Thank you. Yes.
And I felt like maybe we can take this ride together and pop in on some of the stories throughout your book. One of the first stories you talk about is where it all began. Mm-hmm. And you talk about indigo.
Yeah.
And the indigo trade.
Yeah.
And can you tell us a little bit, because we're going to fly there together.
Yes. Right. I mean, indigo is so interesting because it, you know, it's a gorgeous color. And it captivates the globe. I mean, everybody is yearning for this color. And there's something so human about, you know, wanting beauty. And, you know, in West Africa, people are cultivating indigo as well. And what I wanted to track was this transition from black people cultivating indigo and wearing indigo and this being adorned in this beautiful color to a point where human beings begin to be traded for indigo. That is part of what happens in slavery. And I wanted to take the reader to a place where that is happening. What was that like to see something that perhaps you yourself had cultivated? Somehow you're seen as the same value as this block of dye and you're traded for it. And so something beautiful is turned into a desire that is so great that it would lead to the greatest cruelty. You know, we know what the Middle Passage was like, how horrific, and yet still love blue. And so then I'm thinking, you know, the finding of pleasure and beauty in the condition of being enslaved is something that I also think is really important to talk about. people still wanting to wear blue, painting, you know, their porches blue. The history of Haint blue porches in South Carolina is connected to this, finding spiritual meaning in the color. I think that's also a part of what is so kind of mystical and beautiful about embracing blackness in the face of this cruelty and ugliness.
And now I want to sort of fly in time.
Yes. Okay, let's get off. Get back on.
I know. We're going to fly and to a time during the Civil War.
Yeah.
And the boys in blue.
Boys in blue.
That blue fabric on the Union soldiers' uniforms.
Yes.
And how it transformed, that meaning of that blue fabric transformed over time. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah. And there's all these references. So I'm like sort of going into archives and seeing all these people talking about the boys in blue coming to the plantation, this sign that slavery is over, but also what it meant for black men to put on this Union blue uniform to free themselves during the Civil War. So that has a powerful meaning, right? The blue as the color of liberation. But those uniforms became, you know, after the war was over, began to be used for police forces. And we know the history of black folks with policing, and it's a long history. You know, we talk about it as though this question just came up in the context of Black Lives Matter. But if you just look at the history of black newspapers, you're talking about 100-plus-year history of people talking about tension with police officers. So there's this transformation from the uniform as a symbol of liberation to the uniform as a symbol of punishment and injustice.
Yeah. And do you think the shifting symbolism of this blue uniform sort of reflects broader changes, though, and the power structure of not just America, but also black people?
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, this, the one of the great tragedies of American history is that the promises of Reconstruction were betrayed. The promise of full access to citizenship, the promise of, you know, of equal protection before the law, the promise of voting rights, they're delayed for generations. And in some ways, you know, that cycle of the promise and the backlash, we've never gotten out of it. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the story of the book, too, because blue has this quality of being both hopeful and mournful. Of, you know, it's a color that I say is contrapuntal. It moves both ways. So it works in a sense metaphorically, because we have these seasons of hope and we have these seasons of devastating disappointment. Sort of like the two steps forward, one step back, or the two steps forward, three steps back. Right. That has been the journey of black Americans. Yeah.
Yeah. And staying in that Reconstruction period, the story that also stood out to me was the story of the blue black speller. I had never heard this story.
Oh, yeah.
And this was during Reconstruction when formerly enslaved black people were learning to read.
Yes. And one of the, you know, it's one of those things that I wish everybody knew, the unbelievable passion for literacy. I mean, black people filled schoolhouses from every age, from tiny itty bitty children to elders post emancipation. And the way that most learned to read was with Noah Webster's Blueback Speller. And part of the reason that was so, it was so important, is that it was a way of learning to read that you could teach yourself
very easily. What exactly
was it?
Was
an autodidact. It's like, there, I have one at home. It's like a thin blue book, you know, on regular paper. And it, but it was seen as this treasure to have this book that you could use to teach yourself to read. And it had little moral lessons in it too. And so if you actually look at the, you know, the memoirs, the autobiographies of black folks during that period, Booker T. Washington, you know, the stories of George Washington Carver, that's what they used to learn to read.
And that's such a, that's one of the stories of hope.
Yeah.
But then a story that also stood out to me, first of all, I laughed out loud and then I gasped and grab some imaginary pearls. It was the story of the blue gum Negroes.
I know, it's so great.
I mean, was like, what in the world is this story?
Right.
It had all the elements.
Yes. And this is, it's a tricky one to talk about because it actually is black folks who are telling this story.
Oh.
Even though it kind of crosses over, this is the story went, is that if you were bitten by a blue gum Negro, a black person with blue gums, they could kill you. That the bite of the blue gum Negro was poisonous, right? And so people, and this circulated so widely, you know, it crossed racial lines, but it circulated so widely that dental journals were talking about it. So I read articles in, like, you know, late 19th and early 20th century dental journals where they're like, what is this? You know, we have to study the bite of the blue gum Negro, right? I mean, it's wild. And then
it's so crazy.
It's so crazy. And then it makes its way it's in the Atlantic magazine. You find it in newspapers. You find it even in William Faulkner's writing. And I'm fascinated by it because, on the one hand, it's like, oh, this is very clearly mythological, and it's in many of these contexts, it's kind of racist. But I also think about it as a kind of power, like mm-hmm. this idea. Because imagine, you think about how close in the South black and white people were physically. Black people were doing domestic labor, they're driving the carriages and the car. And so, if that person could just turn around and bite you,
and kill you.
Right? So, it's a kind of like mystical power. People with blue gums were seen as particularly good at hoodoo and the like. And the other piece that I now understand is that it may have happened because human bites are very dangerous. And there's a lot of bacteria in anybody's mouth. So it's possible for someone to have bitten someone and that person to have died, because that could happen today if you're not treated with the antibiotics. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's like there's always sort of that little bit of maybe a little factoid in it. But it's funny, and it also speaks to, for me, to this recognition, even in the sort of most vulnerable times, there's this acknowledgement that black people had power, even if mm-hmm. the description was wrong, but that there was some power there.
Yeah. And that leads me to this question. How do you see myths like that fitting into the broader history of how blackness and even color itself can be used to stoke fear, but also oppression?
Yeah. No, it's such a good question, because part of my method was I talk in the book about what I do is haunting the past, which is, you know, walking around in the past and trying to have a more ethical relationship to it as a storyteller than the powers that be did, which means that I'm listening to various sources of knowledge and wisdom. So I treat the lore, I treat the folk tales in the same way that I treat the historic facts. And I do that because whether or not they are factual, they were doing something, they were saying something.
Yeah, and I tell you, using this vehicle to sort of fly through space and time, so brilliant. Could you read the selection, this one about music?
Yes. What I mean when I say that my people gave a sound to the world's favorite color is this. In the blue above, flight is possible. In the blue over the edge of the ship, one plummets to death. Hell was the bottom of the ocean floor until it became salvation. You had to swing mighty low to bring them up to the blue sky, weightless to memory and suffering. A voice could do it. A chorus could ensure it. In the main and in the meantime of history, blackness insisted upon standing inside of life with a song. The series of catastrophic encounters on the coast of West Africa, the degradation that took on myriad forms in the Americas, and then the broken promise of freedom and citizenship, well, that was all awful. But conditions being what they were, people kept living with what was at their disposal, like blackberries on the bramble bush.
I just love that selection.
Thank you.
And in the book, you spend some time sort of tracing the journey of blues music from the fields to the juke joints to what we hear now globally.
Yeah.
Sort of what struck you as you were pulling together different pieces of that history?
I think what struck me is that you think about how extraordinary it was to create a musical tradition that impacts the entire world and transforms Western music. So we talk about the blue note, right? The worried note, the space in between notes, the bent note, the way that black people did something different with Western musical structures. And then that changes everything. And to do that actually in daily life, there's this incredible recorded music and performed music. But the root of this is that this was how people were choosing to live with song, with creating unbelievable beauty. That kind of disposition to living is just so powerful. It's one of the most profoundly human things. Like, and it's, I treasure it because it's my tradition, it's our tradition, right? Mm-hmm. But I also recognize that if I step outside, this is something that the world needs to heed about what it means to be a human being.
I just want to say, you went so deep as to trace it back to the person named Blue in the fields,
yeah,
who for the first time sang like a work song, mm-hmm, that sort of told the story and the strife of the people who, yeah, were working,
yeah,
in front of the white oppressor,
absolutely,
in their face,
yeah,
and everybody looking like, oh my goodness, right, who's saying this,
right,
this,
right,
is some powerful stuff. Can you please,
yeah,
tell that story?
So it's when Alan Lomax, who was a famous collector of folklore and blues music, and has left one of the most important sort of records of the music, and it's at the Library of Congress. But he goes to this plantation and he's asking to hear the Ballad of Stagaly, which is one of these long rhyming folk ballads that provided the foundation for hip hop and the like, right? And this man, Blue, who's in the field with other men working who's been asked to perform this, it says that first he wants to sing his own song. And he sings a song about injustice. Mm. And while the person who's the boss is there, and also Lomax, who is a white man, is there. And it's just a brilliant example, because we also often neglect how much day-to-day resistance and refusal and telling people about themselves took place, even in the context of a sharecropping situation. So it's a beautiful story. And I also, you know, the names, the Blue is a name throughout Black culture and history. Mm-hmm. I love that aspect. And I hadn't ever thought about it explicitly until I began writing this book. And I was like, oh, yeah, there's Blues all over the place. Like, people named Blue all over the place. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah, really people powerful. Have Blue Ivy. Look.
Yeah.
Beyonce named her kids Blue.
Yes.
And so you think about that. And I think what would get lost if you tried to separate Black people from the Blues?
You just can't. I mean, people do try. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it, for me, part of it is you don't have any American music without the blues as a foundation. So people try to separate. You know, we see this with the efforts of the country music industry to try to say that that's not Black music, or, you know, rock music industry to try to say, but it all depends on the blues.
Yeah, and all goes back.
Yeah.
And so much is sort of happening in America right now. It's a scary time.
It's
for
terrifying.
A lot of people. And I know this book has been years in the making, but did you come across any moments in your research where you felt like history was sort of speaking to what is happening right now?
Yeah. I mean, I love that question, because I have been thinking a great deal about how important it is to actually value what the ancestors have to teach us. I think, so we run the risk when we think about how far we've come to think, well, they could not have contemplated our situation. But what we can see now is they absolutely could have contemplated our situation. And they went through things that we are encountering now. And they did enough to ensure that we are here. So we ought to listen to their wisdom as we confront this challenging moment. And one of the ways for me I've sort of found this is the kind of ethical and spiritual and social, in the sense of like being connected to one another, resources that they inculcated, right? And a general resourcefulness in the world. And the biggest part, I think, is to be imaginative and creative. We sort of push those off as just the sort of like kind of extracurriculars to life. Mm-hmm. But actually figuring out how to live in the storm requires a lot of imagination and creativity. Mm-hmm. And we need to turn to that.
Yeah, they were so creative. They
so
survivors
creative.
And thrivers,
yes,
despite just unimaginable oppression.
Yeah.
And it's a gift. What do you hope people carry from this book? What do you hope they take with them and keep with them?
I hope that what the book allows them to do is to see the world in some refreshed and meaningful ways, so that there's something that like ignites for the reader, and they walk through the world and they see Blue, they encounter Blues, and it makes them think about how to tell their own stories. Every time I write a book, I always say it's an invitation. And so I want this book to be an invitation too. I want it to be something that like, be, I don't know, it's an impulse for people to create on their own.
Mm-hmm. I just feel like you have fun writing this book.
I did.
Because you got to be so creative and fly through time and space. Yeah. I literally could see you like being like the comic book characters flying through.
I love
through.
That because I kind of imagine that.
Yeah, so. That's what it feels like reading this book. And so blue is a color so many of us love. Is that your favorite color?
Oh, yeah. And black.
Yeah. And we'll leave it right there. That was National Book Award winning author Imani Perry speaking about her latest book, Black and Blues, How a Color Tells the Story of My People. You can listen to Studio 2 live on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays at noon on 90.9 FM or streaming on YouTube. Our show is produced by Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Al Banks engineered today's Studio 2 Extra. From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg. Thanks for listening.